traveling. I said, working here and there, working my way at my trade. I was a painter, house painter. And I learned a good many lessons during that period of 6 years. Well, I worked in Germany, of course, particularly in Switzerland, and then I worked in France, more relatively briefly, but I worked there. And then I traveled with two Germans who were both socialists down to Italy, over to Greece, down to Egypt, Palestine, and then up to Romania. Now, on that trip, we didn't work. We had saved money so we could make our way, but of course, we had to travel in the most economical fashion possible. That is, always traveling just with a knapsack. Everything we own is in a knapsack. There's sort of enough room for a little bread and sauces to keep yourself alive. But Romania worked for 2 years. And that's one place where I really happened to learn a good deal in my trade. And I made money, too. So that was the last stop of my travel. But at the same time, you know, this accumulation of experiences, we'll take the working class experiences, particularly in Germany, where I got into my first strike. And a May Day demonstration, gigantic thing, everybody up with their trade union banner. Entirely new lessons for me. Couldn't help to begin to do some thinking, because I was just a pretty bourgeois oriented kid when I started out. My father was a teacher, although we have a tenant family, we were poor. And because we were poor, we moved to one of the most backward rural areas in Denmark. So I didn't have much schooling either. We had only 2 grades, and we went to school. So, of course, that was one of the factors that particularly urged me to get out of the constricted surroundings in Denmark. But I learned one lesson after another, you know, that finally came to the point I became class conscious. I became convinced I'm a socialist and I want to work for socialist ideas, socialist movement. And that was the state of mind when I landed here in the United States.
Why did you come to the United States?
Well, you know, after having traveled in other countries, and mostly bigger countries, particularly Germany then, was a really advancing country, highly developed technologically. I came back to Denmark. I couldn't fit into the constricted surroundings that I once tried to escape. And it was very difficult to go back to Europe because the First World War was on. That was up when I was in Romania. There I also came to Romania and Greece. I came into contact with the Balkan War. So, of course, there were many lessons learned, many rich experiences. So, when I came to the United States, I decided I'm going to join the Socialist Party. I happened to land in Chicago because coming to the United States at that period, you had to give the name of a relative to whom you were going to, whom you were going to see anyway. You had to have $25 in your pocket. It wasn't much, but I managed that all right. For that, I made good money in Romania. So, the second day I was here, I saw a sign in Swedish, the Swedish Socialist. I remember and said, I want to join. Well, they were flabbergasted. They never got the recruits ready, nothing. But I was set, I was convinced I want to be a socialist. I want to work for them and be part of the movement, the part that's all we had from the Socialist Party. Then I also joined the IWW.
Is this in Chicago?
In Chicago, yes. Why did IWW headquarters, strange enough, that is what happened. When I joined the Socialist Party, it was organized by foreign language federations. So I was assigned to the Scandinavian Federation. And I soon learned a little bit about the IWW and the ideas. Milton Scott was attracted me. So I came to IWW headquarters now and then asking for a speaker to come before our branch of the Socialist Party. And one day I was sent up to speak with Edward himself. And he said, "Very much, you fellows will never line up anyway." So I said, "By God, I'll line up right now." So I joined. But I was attracted to the IWW.
What was attractive about the IWW compared to the Socialist Party?
Look, the Socialist Party was predominantly oriented on electoral politics. The IWW was oriented on fighting the battle wherever you are on the job. And he also held out the idea for a new, he was fighting for a new social order. He wasn't too clear just what that new social order would mean, nor was I, so I didn't hold me back at all. But another aspect also coming here, I wanted to see more of the United States and know more about it. I didn't stay in Chicago for very long. I skipped out, you know. That time you could get free fare and you would go to a certain city to work. Up to Casper, Wyoming, booming because of oil. Big oil dwellings just beginning there. The town was booming. I went up there at 3K, I got up there. Worked as a painter. And I was there when the triumphant peals of revolution had turned up in Russia. And that, of course, got me very much excited too. Very interested. Emotionally, sentimentally, with it from the very beginning.
Were you working as a wobbling up in Tampa, or were you?
I was working as a painter, but also a member of my union, trade union.
But there was no wobbly local?
There was no wobblies in Tampa. I once met one, sort of more or less traveling through. But there were no wobbly organizations. But then the news brought about the Washington Revolution, you know, then I realized that's something really big and really new. And of course, I wanted to know much more about it, and I also wanted to work on that line. That was my outlook. And I knew about the Northwest at the IWW has carried on some very intense and very effective battles, particularly for better conditions in the logging industry. This is big industry, big business here. So that was sort of the point of attraction. Together with two other comrades, well, three of these, as a matter of fact, two Danes, I was born in Denmark. And a Swiss, who somehow connected up with us in Casper. Then went through Yellowstone Park on the way home to see that. The two comrades of mine, we had bought a Ford Model T. They owned it. I had no ownership in it. They owned it. So we went through Yellowstone Park. I was interested in art too. These paintings were mine. I did sketching of the Yellowstone Park, and then finally I also became the secretary. I wanted to get up to Glacier National Park, just by the Canadian border. And the others wouldn't go there, so I went there alone, hiding through it. And then took photographs and stuff, and seen what it was. But the landing in Seattle, that was my objective. And then naturally, with this live movement there, the effect, you know, of all these IWW battles, more so than the Socialist Party, was noticeable throughout the labor movement. And many of the IWWs there were working in the AFL unions. These are not the syndicalist type here. And he wanted to work in a mass movement where they put and they carried two cars. Well, of course, that's a guy. So we sort of had a kind of a loose form left wing development in several of these movements. The IWW was particularly strong amongst the longshoremen and also quite well in the shipyard. And they were two big factors, you see. That was almost the center of the shipbuilding and industry at the time. So, of course, that made the Seattle labor movement a good deal different from the rest of the country. Sort of right. It was out in the forefront. Otherwise, I don't believe a general strike would have been possible.
How did how did it happen still that it, I guess I'm still not clear on why so many unions did so much to go out in support of the shipyard strike. How did that happen? I mean, when people had, when the Central Labor Council, I think the year before, the Central Labor Council had voted on whether to back a general strike for meeting. And there hadn't been, there was some support for that, but there wasn't a type of mass rank and file support that seemed to have carried the general strike. There was that mass rank and file support. Why didn't the Mooney general strike happen then? The first one was called off by Mooney himself. Is that right?
That came after the general strike. The strike that was supposed to be called for Tom Moon was supposed to be nationwide. I was sent out by the Seattle Labor Council then as one of the organizers. The council sent out three organizers. I became one of them. And my territory was down in Centralia. And there I didn't find much sympathy for the idea. Because they were all bitterly hostile to IWW, except the railroad workers. Well, anyway, but that happened after the general strike. The general strike took place in February. Well, look, the shipyard workers wanted a wage increase. About 35,000 of them. We were meeting together in the Metal Trades Council, the AFL. And the shipyard owners were adamant. Wouldn't negotiate at all. Now, here we have to remember that the war had actually come to an end. And that's why the shipyard owners could foresee that the industry would be on a downgrade. There would not be that great demand for new ships once the war is over. But they were so adamant they wouldn't even negotiate at all. And it really meant that the Metal Trades Council there, all the workers in the shipyard, were completely stymied. So they turned to the Central Labor Council, asking for support for a general strike. And the night that was debated in the council, way past midnight, way past.
Now you were, some of the things that you told me, I don't think we got on the tape, so. You were a member of the Central Labor Council at that time?
I was a delegate, from my local union.
Which was the Painters?
Painters Local Number 300.
Uh-huh.
I became a delegate shortly after I came to Seattle. because I was a live wire, you know. And you find often in these AFL unions, very few people are interested in being delegates to central bodies. And that's really where things happen. Most of them are more interested in their own local body. That's very often the case. And this is a good deal of the case in Seattle, too. So when I was willing to be a delegate to the Central Labor Council, I was elected right away. Now, then you have to remember also, the Seattle Central Labor Council published a daily paper, the Seattle Union Record. Something unusual. No other central labor body would ever think of undertaking that at a time elsewhere in the country. Although some of these bodies were much bigger than a city like Seattle. And they sent, and the Seattle Union Record had, was generally speaking, quite up to the left. Very sympathetic to the Bolshevik Revolution. Published at one time Lenin's speech completely.
Was the Union Record sort of talking to the left of where most of the rank and file were, or was it about?
The rank and file was really a good deal left-oriented, too, because of this impact of IWW ideas and the Socialist Party to some extent, because we were just beginning to organize the left wing in the Socialist Party. And our policy there was, first of all, follow the class struggle, fight the class struggle. Not so much in the parliamentary team, but wherever it happens, or wherever it may be, in the shops, or wherever it may be, fight the class struggle. And then also industrial unionism as against craft unionism, which was also a very progressive idea, left idea, and had taken great hold in Seattle. At one time, I recall the Seattle Union Record came out with a great big headline saying, one big union, one table. And that reflected the rank and file. The Seattle Union Record did not go entirely cut loose from the rank and file. No, it could have been followed it. But it was in the forefront.
Why was the leaders of the AFL, like the Alt and Falcon and those people, seem to accept the idea of one big union. Why was there this hostility that they sometimes show towards the IWW as a dual union?
There wasn't that hostility. I'll give you examples of the exact opposite. The exact opposite. The secretary of the Central Labor Council is Scotsman, little red-headed fellow, but with a powerful voice and a brilliant orator. He was sort of one of the left, spearheading left. He was the secretary of the council, had a high post.
Is Jimmy Duncan?
Jimmy Duncan. What's his name? Hugh Van Wells, who served president, had at one time been the chairman of the Central Labor Party. Now that is gives you somewhat of an idea of the general power of the body. It was a body that really reflected the rank and file on and responded to the rank and file and was in front, but not moving too far out to move away from the rank and file. That is never did. So it was a sort of a phenomenon that you found in Seattle at the time that could not be duplicated in any other city in the United States. At that time, not. At other times, yes. Yeah. There have been other instances. Seattle is not the only case. There. At that meeting, you know, when the shipyard workers asked for support to a general strike, of course, the conservatives were against it, that's obvious. He said, well, can we then? We need to support contract with the bosses. Well, that was who the Dow. Edward Mitchell, General Strike was cheered to the echo, you know. And the manifest, you know, the meeting was really, it's not in turmoil, but it was very demonstrative. Oh, the debate went on, I was not interrupted. But everything was very demonstrative. So a big majority carried the vote. And they submitted, the Central Labour Council submitted then the question to a referendum vote of all the unions, carried by a big majority. So the shows the whole labour movement was well advanced.
What was the strike like?
Huh? Do what?
What was the general strike like once it started?
The next?
No, what was it like? What was it like?
I'll give you some idea of that. Now, every union struck, no exceptions. It meant about 65,000 organized workers. Some Japanese trade organizations joined in. Trade organization, more or less. IWW, wherever we had any organizations, their own separate apart from those, joined with. And many unorganized, and not many, but some unorganized workers. There were not so many because Seattle was a very organized city already then. The strike was complete. The first problem, of course, was to feed the people. Many the workers there were just young fellows, unmarried. They had not established a family tradition yet. They had come to Seattle, you know, to work in particularly the shipbuilding industry. So we set up a number of feeding stations, feeding about 20,000 to 30,000 people every day, run by the culinary trades. Just turn over to them, they did purchasing and cooking, preparing the food and everything. AFL cars or IW cars were equally good, but we had to pay for it for a very low price. That was the first problem. Then next came the question now, well, what about certain activities that are important, like hospitals and so on? Now, the General Strike Committee never unseated the mayor or his councillors, but it was the city government, in fact, during those days of the strike lasted, you know, it didn't last very long. Thursday morning, Thursday noon, till Tuesday, no, this is the opposite, from Tuesday to Thursday, the next week. At any rate, it lasted only a number of days. You know, strike can't go on forever, unless you want to take power. And that was not the idea. Now, that was one aspect of feeding the people. Then next, even the mayor himself, the city, and the hospital administration came before the General Strike Committee. That is not the whole body. We elected an executive of 15 that was sort of handling the day-to-day affairs. We came before that body, asking for exemption. Now, exemption was granted for hospitals, for necessary deliveries, for pharmacies, that is, for drugstores, to fill prescriptions only, and for city garbage collectors, to collect all garbage that may otherwise become a sanitary party, but not collect anything else. And in each case, turned over to the particular trade of concern, where, for example, trucks that would pick up the garbage had a great big sign by permission of the strike committee. That means that thing was flashed all over the city. So it became so much known, you know, the General Strike Committee was the one that decided what was to go on and what was not to go on. Appeals came also from private concerns, turned out. So we wouldn't let any of them move, not any of them. No exemptions on them, as far as we were concerned. Now, that's another aspect of it. And a third one, for example, we established our own police because we were well enough aware that, well, it should have come to big demonstrations that may be just an excuse for the local police, for the mayor's police, who had hired, you know, a whole army of new police officers and thugs to help them. Total police or whatever it could get, armed to the teeth, purchased guns. All private companies purchased guns. So we knew that was important that there be not any incident happen that could furnish an excuse for the police. So we had our own police. Not armed, just a ban around your arm. Whenever too many people gathered, then police would go over and say, no, please, let's break it up. It's better. It's better. Strike is more successful that way. Everybody agreed. Nothing needed but persuasion. I think this sort of 2 points will give a bit of an idea how complete the strike was. And how complete it was in the sense of undivided support and dedication by the members of the union.
What about the votes workers who are not members of the union, who are the middle class? I don't know how large that was. Was there support from the general population for the strike? Some accounts say that after
The lines were very clearly drawn in the general population too. Very clearly drawn. To begin with, you know, the mayor, Ole Hansen, who really was a big fool. He was a sort of corporate politician, a typical American politician who was very mediocre, and that's a really know nothing outside of political tricks. He had been a patent salesman, patent medicine salesman before. He had been selling Kickapoo Indian Sagua. So he was a kind of a jovial man, tried to play both sides. Now to begin with, or by the way, let me give you an idea also of the attitude to Ole Hansen. The Central Labor Council, we had our own building, owned by the Central Labor Council, and a good sized hall for our meetings, a gallery. One night, the mayor himself was in the gallery, and he made an interruption in the debate. And he was challenged right away. Even Jimmy Duncan says, "No, wasn't it you who said that every IWW should be strung up in a lamppost?" And he had actually made that kind of a statement. So he kind of tried to weasel out of it. And you know, the whole audience of delegates, right, they rooted him down. Pretty rough treatment for the mayor of the city. Well, at the very first couple of days of the strike, he was going to be the mediator. And came forward in that all, called upon the unions to mediate the strike. But he was curtly told by the banking fraternity, nothing doing. We consider, you know, Spangler, who was the head of the banking fraternity, says, "My people take the stand, this is a revolution, and we will not negotiate the revolutionaries. There will be no mediation." Mayor Ole Hansen had to stop that. Then he called, proclaimed, he issued a proclamation for the citizens who were to work, continue their daily activities under his protection. And naturally calling upon the Sligo to call the Sligo off immediately, he'll declare martial law. Nothing happened. Nobody paid any attention to it. Then he retreated, issued a proclamation for the next day, or he would declare martial law. Nothing happened. Well, when we came to Saturday, then the Executive Committee of 15, and you know, when you have an Executive Committee elected from such a large body as the General Strike Committee, which was composed of 3 delegates from each union, and not all of them sent 3 delegates, and to my local union, I was the only one. But they were all entitled to send 3 delegates. Still, it was a large body. So naturally, the Executive Committee, or sort of in charge of day-to-day decisions and activities, was composed primarily of union officials, which means they were more conservative then.
Why did they bother? Why did you say that? Why was that? Because they were better known?
That is usually the case, you know. Look. You could imagine here if a central body was to be sent up here and say in Los Angeles, delegates from each union, well, he would be all there, nobody would know one another. It would be an accident if he did. So that's the way it usually happens. Officials whose names are known are the ones that become the Executive Committee. On Saturday, he came in with a unanimous decision proposing to call off the strike. It started Tuesday. Oh, no, I'm sure that it started on Tuesday or Thursday. But one day was Thursday and the other day was Tuesday. That means the beginning and the end. It started Tuesday. Start Thursday. Saturday, only 2 days, you know. The Executive Committee came into the General Strike Committee with a unanimous resolution to call the strike off that day at 12 that day. Yeah, 12 o'clock. Now, that, of course, led to a big debate all day, all night. 4:30 in the morning, finally, the Executive Committee proposals turned down flatly and completely. The rank and file showed its greater determination than the officials did. Well, after all, it hadn't demonstrated really anything yet, and nor had it really brought any near the claims of the shipyard workers. So it turned down flat. The strike went on. But next Monday morning, at a roll call, they had a roll call at the committee meeting every morning, but there were 2 unions missing. He had gone back to work on orders of their international officials. But they sent word to the strike committee. He say, if in your judgment we should come out again, we will.
That was a very dangerous thing for them to do, wasn't it? Hadn't some of the international threatened to revoke their charters if they
Well, look, revoking charters has happened many times in the unions. But at that stage in 1919, the international officialdom of Theodore was not quite as powerful as we are today. Not quite as powerful. But there was the danger, of course. But nevertheless, the local union is more depending on the unions in his area than he is on the international officials who may be sitting in Washington or some other city far away. More depending on them, and especially in this right situation. But some, about a few meetings, he has been ordered back by their international officials. He's in war. That is, the judgment of the strike committee should come out again to work instantly. And that's what we decided. That we should come out again, and then we should all go back the next day, that's on Tuesday, at noon, with lines closed. Now that was important, you know, to have a united end to the strike, instead of the strike, you know, sort of petering out by one human after another dribbling back. And then it would have been just an outright defeat. This meant it enormously stimulated the spirit and the solidarity of all of them. We came out again.
Why was it necessary to go back at all? Why was the force of the strike starting to end away?
Was it necessary to go back to work, you mean?
Why did the strike end?
Look. Now, a general strike that ties up a whole community. You know, we have to feed people. Shows you how everybody, they are depending on it. It just cannot continue indefinitely. It must come to an end somewhere. Unless it's led by revolutionaries for the purpose of taking power. Then you continue, but then you also advance and extend it and advance.
So it can't stay at that point.
You got to get off that point. You either have to come to an end, or you have to go forward to challenge the whole state authorities. And that was not the objective. He was not a revolutionary. He was claimed to be by the bourgeois press, but we knew, all of us here, that this is just a strike in sympathy of the shipyard workers.
Was there any hope among the radicals in the movement that it might develop into something larger than just a sympathy strike?
There were certain elements, and mostly among the robbers, no, you continue to strike. Well, but continuing one, what for? You got to have a specific objective to do.
Were you yourself in support of continuing the strike or ending it?
No, actually for ending it. I had learned enough by then to know that was necessary. I even had to argue with some of my good fellow worker robbers. Unless you're ready to struggle for power.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was never really part of the IWW concept to take over the state powers. He always thought he could take over society, create a new social order, just through actions on the job, through the factories. He had to take over the state power, too.
I do want to add, Mr. Martin, I do want to ask you, after I finish these questions I have, I do want to ask you something about how you yourself change from a direct action perspective to the point where you became part of the drive to found the Communist Party. But maybe I'll ask you questions about the strike before we go on to that point. Would that be all right?
Okay.
Is it more that if you ask the point about the strike before I answer some specific questions? Is there more that you have to tell me about the strike before I ask you these specific questions? Or?
No, I think that. Except, of course, I must add this. The strike did not bring the increase for the shipyard workers. It was a gigantic demonstration. And that's really all it could be. And it was more or less conceived in that sense. We did not all feel in advance that we were going to rule out the shipyard workers that their increase. Because it was even known then the shipyards were owned by banks in New York. no local Seattle owners of the yards anymore.
Skinner and Eddie was no longer owned by Skinner and Eddie?
No, owned by Bax in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Monopoly capitalism was already quite well advanced. Quite well advanced. So that's perhaps one aspect of Skinner and Eddie. He's not doing that. The man for the shipyard workers. But it also happened to occur just when the employers were beginning their open shop offensive. It was just the time when the employers, as the war came to an end, they had won the war for democracy. Now they were really going to come against labor at home. Started a big open shop campaign.
Now, this may be a crucial point in the research I've been doing. Do you feel that the open shop campaign was begun before the general strike?
It was already intimations of it.
So the employers had already made that decision before the general strike occurred?
Oh, yes. No, when I speak about the employers' open shop offensive, that's a national phenomenon, not just Seattle. National phenomenon.
Uh-huh.
And this battle made in Seattle helped the unions elsewhere sort of stiffen their backbones to better meet the employers' offensive. You know, a big action by labor in one part of the country does have its effect on labor elsewhere. That's even a worldwide phenomenon. Big action on the world. Like for example, the revolution in Russia. The revolution in Russia had a tremendous effect on the Seattle labor movement, too. Maybe more so than most other parts of the country, because between the West Coast and Vladivostok, there had been actual communication. Ships coming from Vladivostok to Seattle Harbor after the Bolsheviks had taken power. So that had an impact too.
I'm going to ask you a little bit more
in
a little while.
Of course, your questions, whichever you.
Okay. A lot of the things that I have to ask you have covered, so I'm going to be skipping around a little. You said that you were born in Denmark. Is that right?
Yes.
And when was that?
1890.
And your father was a preacher?
He was a painter by trade, and my parents were both born in Norway. But he immigrated to Denmark and settled there and got married there. And he worked only very briefly at trade. Then he was religious when he came to Denmark. And then he became a lay preacher. He and two others were the leading elements in splitting away from the Danish state-supported Lutheran church.
Hmm.
He wanted to preach the pure gospel, get away from the ceremonial sort of the official church. He wanted to preach the pure gospel. So that meant that he was one of the leaders of that small religious group, but it had some support, almost 12 Denmark, number of cities. So he had to travel all the time to sustain the flock. My mother had to be the disciplinarian for 10 kids.
Uh-huh. She stayed home. Yeah.
But they were both in the same church.
Did they discuss politics at home?
Strange enough, you know, my father had advanced social views. For example, when he came home from his trips, he would always bring along the paper Social Democrat, that is the Social Democratic paper. That's all that was available then. From the left, the Social Democratic Party, that was the left. And I always liked to read it. by my age, when I was age nine, before war broke out in South Africa. And of course, I didn't know about the racial question involved, not about really imperialism involved, but the Boers were the underdogs. So I was an enthusiastic supporter of the Boers. At one point then, one time he came home, he did not find the paper. I asked him, why? I want to read it. He says he has become too respectable. And he pulled out of his pocket the syndicalist paper. That was the opposition from the left at that time. And he said, read that. I give you another example. In 1922, I went to the Soviet Union as a delegate from the American Communist Party to work with the Communist International Executive Committee. Stayed 6 months there, and also a delegate for the Fourth Congress. On the way, I passed through Denmark because I had a boy, 9 years old, who was very much older. Very soon, 11 years old. No, on the pardon. Before 1921. Sometimes I get mixed up in my dates. No, he was just a baby beginning to talk, beginning to walk. My wife and he was left in Denmark while I went to the Soviet Union. And so naturally, I miss this is my folks too. And we were going to have some church affair just then. And he asked me if I'd come along. I said, well, you know, it's no use. You know, I disagree. You knew that perfectly well. You knew I was a communist. He said, it doesn't matter. There are many there who knew you as a child. They'd like to see you again. So, well, finally I went. And he introduced me proudly to all of as a communist. And he says, you remember the early Christians were communists. They shared in common the fruits of their labor and operated as a communist society. But of course, he also told me that the communism is all right, but not separate apart from God. And with that, of course, we couldn't agree. So, well, that was just a couple of instances I mentioned to show of his views there.
He's been generally sympathetic to the left and to the workers when he was on that job. And did you go to school there in Denmark?
Because of the fact that he had to travel for the mission, had fallen away from the official church, he was reduced to pretty much of a poverty level because that church couldn't find the much to sustain life, and the family kept growing. After the tour, I was number two. After the birth of the first two, my brother, my older brother and I, we moved out to a rural area in Denmark where we had enough land to raise a bit of vegetable potatoes to help with the feed, raise chicken, fowl, have a pig, feed the pig, and slaughter at Christmas time. That helped along the food problem. But that also meant that we could go to school just in a little village. And the school there had two grades. One for the little kids, little tots, and one for the big kids. But it so happened that my school teacher was a rather well-versed historian. And he would often recite from history, and that always had me fascinated. And he noticed I paid rapt attention, and he would answer then whatever questions I posed. Although the type of questions I posed him were, why? What happened? Not why. I hadn't come that far.
Moving on to the strike a little, I think how you answered most of the questions I have of it. You were doing
for paper contract.
Do you remember if there was any violence during the strike?
No.
None
at all. But I'll give you other examples of violence. None at all. At one time, look here, I failed to mention, at the beginning of the strike, the executive committee of 15 also decided by itself to suspend the publication of the Soviet Union record under the namby-pamby of fairness to the other papers whom we had, which we had shut down. And in place of the daily paper should be just a mini strike bulletin. The second day the paper was missing was a tremendous demonstration gathered around the Central Labor Council. Many thousands of strikers demanding their paper. The craving for information was as great as the craving for food. And that's very natural in a strike situation. Particular strike situation where everything is posed very sharply. Who's the enemy? Who are you fighting against? And that's very sharp, very sharply posed and quite well understood. He demanded their paper. And then, of course, we had a meeting of the General Strike Committee. We immediately decided the Soviet Union record was soon publication.
That, I hadn't understood that before. I thought that the reason the decision was made to continue was to start again, printing the Union record, was because the Star was putting out their strike paper and distributing a lot of
incorrect information. That was not the reason, but here's what happened to the Star. That was one of the future days. It attempted to publish the very first day of the strike, or maybe it was the second. And we had police drawn up covering the whole short street where the crack, the printing crack, was located. We had to hand out the paper. Nobody would take it. Nobody. Only up in the more well-heeled areas where the paper was distributed by armed guards. But it was only one sheet. Not a complete paper, only one sheet. We called it a shooting star. So that came to an end just naturally. We didn't make any other attempt.
So it was actually the demonstration of working for the Union record that
That solidarity of the workers and their action, that settled everything during the period of the strike, no matter what. Nothing could escape it. The city owned one streetcar line. Otherwise, most of the streetcars were owned by private company. But one line they had taken over as a municipal line. The mayor ordered that the cars went out, covered the tracks, do their regular daily one. Well, they just got a little bit outside the bar and they were stuck because nobody would drive, nobody would be conducted. Couldn't find anybody to do it. Cars would be stuck there, see. But I'll give you some examples also of the attitude of the labor movement in the Central Labor Council and some important incidents. The IWW always used to have open air meetings, soapbox meetings. I was amongst the soapboxes. In fact, I was mostly chairman. Get the meeting started and introduce the episode. Are you okay? Are you acquainted with Seattle? Horton, Virginia. There was a big open lot. That's what we held out with our open air meetings. They never failed on Sundays, of course, but also on weekdays whenever we could. But never failed on Sundays. And one day, a very timid meeting was spoken of in very violent fashion by the police. The Central Labor Council immediately passed a resolution that this was an infringement on the right of the whole working class. You didn't see that just as an incident against the IWW, because the meetings were run by the IWW under its auspices. No, they said that was an infringement on the right of the whole working class. And we decided to call another meeting on the same spot.
The CLC,
Central Labor Council. And that meeting was held of about 30,000 or 40,000 workers there. And some of the shipowners had good lead pipes in their pockets too. But, you know, the police had enough sense to stay entirely away. Never even looked at it. Now that's one example of the Central Labor Council. Another one, after this strike, sort of the aftermath of it, naturally the bourgeois powers were trying to find some scapegoats on whom they could unleash their wrath, their anger, the fact that they couldn't get anywhere from the strike. So a number of IWWs were indicted who had not been part of the general strike committee or the acting partners, right? Yes, but not in the leadership at all. And they were not the type who we call two-card men, who were also the acting mayor for that. Generally speaking, they were the lobbyists who were just outfilling the IWW. I think it was 25, 30 and a trial. Central Labor Council immediately passed a resolution, full support to the defense, and will full support. By the way, I must tell you an incident there too on that. George Vanderveer was the attorney for the defense. He was generally called a counsel for the defense because he would take over cases of people who seemed almost entirely hopeless. But try to fight it out. The only lawyer that I ever knew that could fraternize with the Barbies on equal basis. He's a workman type. But he was a very sharp lawyer. He decided that he was going to conduct the trial as an anti-war trial against the AFL reactionary officials. Now, I didn't know exactly what his strategy was, but he asked me if I would testify in the trial. He said, of course, you know, you are a member of the Central Labor Council, you are known as a robbery. You'd be a very good witness.
You were known publicly as both?
Yeah. And that is in the labor movement, the labor rights. Not the true media. My name was never mentioned in the media. So I said, okay, I'll be a witness. So the first question he popped at me on the witness stand, what do you think of Gumpus, the action of Samuel Gumpus, telling the president that in case he decides to go to war, the labor movement will support him? So I'm saying, stunned by that question, because I didn't know that this strategy was particularly an anti-war trial. He really should have told me that before, but I guess he figured I could get by anyway. So I was sort of a little stumped by it, but then I said, well, it's the same as giving the green light to the president, giving the signal to go ahead. But then also I added, in my enthusiasm, you know. But workers pay no attention to Samuel Gumpus, whatever he says. So, the viewers asked, what was that? And I repeated it. So, then, you know, they asked a few more questions, and that was that. I was not a very good witness for an anti-war trial. Now, if he had put me aware of his basic strategy, probably could have done better. Yeah. I don't know. They did not.
But they were, the charges were dropped against those. Or they were acquitted.
Well, then the whole course, and then was sent to the jury, but if you were acquitted. Found the defendant is not guilty. And the Central Labor Council came back with that. The defense had a lot to do with it. Because it's a powerful influence in the city. And you know, the juries, well, after all, they are citizens of the community. Usually, or the quite generally, go to the most backward areas to pick up their denial, to pick up the people that are the prospective viewers. We know enough to do that. I mean, they never go to the area where they find the most intelligent people. But just the same, that the Central Labor Council stand in defense of the IWW. I'm sure they'll have a great effect on the viewers. Now, that's these two examples in the book that mean in defense of the IWW. That's yours. She's the captain of that Central Labor Council. Not that going on AFL type at all.
As a wobbly, did you respect the Central Labor Council then? Did you think it was But not all wobblies did.
No.
Some wobblies feel it was ill to conserve.
The more sort of syndicalist type of IWW, we would have nothing to do with it. But now here I remember I was a political at the same time. I was a member of the Socialist Party and active in its left wing. And being in Seattle, I was one of the delegates from the Seattle Socialist Party to the Chicago Convention 1919 where the strip took place.
Oh, so you were one of the people who was away in Chicago when the first
one of the founders of the Communist Party.
Uh-huh.
We split there. And then if you want to know about it,
yeah, we're
for the separate and apart from Seattle, though. They don't grow more.
What were you doing before? How did you come to Seattle?
Well, there's really a long history in that too. I came to the United States in 1916. But before that, I had traveled throughout the European continent for a period of 6 years. That is, traveling as a worker. Working here and there, working my way. At my trade, I was a painter, house painter. And I learned a good many lessons during that period of 6 years. Well, I worked in Germany, of course, particularly in Switzerland, and then I worked in France, more relatively briefly, but I worked there. And then I traveled with two Germans who were both socialists down to Italy, over to Greece, down to Egypt, Palestine, and then up to Romania. Now, on that trip, we didn't work. We had saved money so we could make our way, but of course, we had to travel in the most economical fashion possible. That is, all this traveling just with a knapsack. Everything we own is in a knapsack. It's sort of enough room for a little bread and sauces to keep yourself alive. But in Romania, I worked for 2 years. And that's one place where I really happened to learn a good deal in my trade. And I made money, too. So that was the last of my travel. But at the same time, you know, this accumulation of experiences, you know, take the working class experiences, particularly in Germany. There I got into my first strike. And a main day demonstration, gigantic thing, everybody up with their trade union banners. Entirely new lessons for me. Couldn't help but begin to do some thinking. Because I was just a pretty bourgeois, yet a kid when I started out. My father was a preacher. Although we were a 10-year family, we were poor. And because we were poor, we moved to one of the most backward rural areas in Denmark. So I didn't have much schooling either. We had only 2 grades. And I went to school. So, of course, that was one of the factors that one particularly urged me to get out of the constricted surroundings in Denmark. But I learned one lesson after another, you know, that finally came to the point I became class conscious. I became convinced I'm a socialist and I want to work for socialist ideas, socialist movement. And that was the state of mind when I landed here in the United States.
Why did you come to the United States?
Well, you know, after having traveled in other countries, and mostly bigger countries, particularly Germany then, was a really advancing country, highly developed technologically. I came back to Denmark. I couldn't fit into the constricted surroundings that I once tried to escape. And it was very difficult to go back to Europe because the First World War was on. That broke up when I was in Romania. There I also came to Romania and Greece. I came into contact with the Balkan War. So, of course, there were many lessons learned, many rich experiences. So, when I came to the United States, I decided, well, I'm going to really get so she's popular. I happened to land in Chicago because coming to the United States at that period, you had to give the name of a relative to whom you were going to, see anyway. You had to have $25 in your pocket. It wasn't much, but I managed that all right. Because I made good money in Romania. So the second day I was here, I saw a sign in Swedish, the Swedish Socialist. I remember and said, I want to join. Well, they were flabbergasted. They never got the recruits that easy. But I was set. I was convinced I wanted to be a socialist. I wanted to work for them and be part of this movement. The part that's all we had from the socialist party. Then I also joined the IWW.
Is this in Chicago?
In Chicago, yes. Why did the IWW headquarters? Strange enough, that is what happened. When I joined the Socialist Party, it was organized by language, foreign language federations. So I was assigned to the Scandinavian Federation. And I soon learned a little bit about the IWW and attracted me, the ideas. Milton spoke of it, attracted me. So I came to IWW headquarters now and then asking for a speaker to come before our branch of the Socialist Party. And one day I was sent up to Big Bit Edward himself. And he said, "Very much to you fellows will never line up anyway." So I said, "By God, I'll line up right now." So I joined. But I was attracted to the IWW.
What was the attraction about the IWW compared to the Socialist Party?
Look, the Socialist Party was predominantly oriented on electoral politics. The IWW was oriented on fighting the battle wherever you are on the job. And he also held out the idea for a new, he was fighting for a new social order. They weren't too clear just what that new social order would mean, nor was I, so that didn't hold me back at all. But another aspect also coming here, I want to see more of the United States and know more about it. I didn't stay in Chicago so very long. I skipped out, you know. That time you could